noteworthy children's books. More news is next.
Good morning. There's no progress in ending the government shutdown, and President Trump is talking of firing people. We'll ask Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen how much pain Democrats are willing to take on Morning Edition from NPR News. The president wants to send the Texas National Guard to Illinois. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The administration says Border Patrol officers are being threatened. City leaders say it's the agents making tensions worse. Also, a young Palestinian journalist's diary documents what it's like to live through Israel's attacks against Gaza, where she says children are not allowed to be children. It is Monday, October 6th. On this day in 1993, Michael Jordan retired from basketball the first time. He came back less than 2 years later. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Today is the sixth day of the federal government shutdown. There's no end in sight. Republicans and Democrats are blaming each other for the impasse. President Trump says the shutdown means that he is laying off federal workers. He says that has already started.
Taking place right now, and it's all because of the Democrats. The Democrats are causing the loss of a lot of jobs with their it's a shutdown. It's their shutdown, not our shutdown. It's their shutdown.
Both sides are deeply set in their positions. Republicans are demanding the Democrats agree to a stopgap bill to lift the shutdown. Democrats say Republicans need to first rescind their deep cuts to federal health care programs. The Senate is scheduled to vote today on a spending measure. A federal judge has again blocked President Trump from deploying National Guard troops to Oregon. This is the judge's second ruling on this issue this weekend. She found that the Trump administration did not meet a legal standard to deploy the National Guard troops. Oregon and California had sued to block Trump's action. Meanwhile, President Trump has also ordered National Guard troops from Texas to go to Illinois, as well as Oregon. Illinois Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker is calling this action, quote, Trump's invasion. And that's not all. NPR's Tom Bowman reports Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has ordered the Illinois National Guard to deploy in Illinois to protect immigration agents and federal facilities.
The troops are expected to deploy to Chicago sometime this week. Hegseth's Saturday memo says the troops are to protect facilities where, quote, violent demonstrations are occurring or could occur based on threat assessments. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker has refused to deploy his guard, so President Trump has taken control by federalizing them. Sending guard troops to protect ICE agents and other federal officers doing their jobs could run afoul of the law. Tom Bowman, NPR News.
Three scientists have been awarded this year's Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine today. NPR's Rob Stein reports this is for their work discovering how the human immune system is kept in check.
The three scientists are two Americans, Mary Brunko and Fred Ramsdell, and one Japanese, Shimon Sekiguchi. The researchers won for explaining something called peripheral immune tolerance. This is a key part of how the immune system protects but does not harm the body. The Nobel Committee says the trio made groundbreaking discoveries that explain the function of cells the committee calls the immune system's security guards, cells called regulatory T cells. Those cells help prevent other immune system cells from attacking healthy tissue. The three scientists will share more than $1.1 million. Rob Stein, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News from Washington. Negotiators from Israel and Hamas are supposed to hold indirect talks today in Egypt. It's about ending the war in Gaza. Tomorrow marks the second anniversary of Hamas's invasion of Israel. President Trump and Arab nations are pressuring the negotiators to work fast. Israel is continuing to strike Gaza, killing dozens of people over the weekend. A study of hundreds of species of mammals finds females tend to outlive males. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports the longevity gap mirrors what is seen in humans and offers clues on how to narrow it.
Women are much more likely to outlive men. On average, men can expect to live 76 years compared to 81 for women. Researchers at the Max Planck Institute studied 528 species of mammals and found females live about 13% longer in many species. Study author Fernando Colchero says genetics play a role, pointing to a protective effect of 2X chromosomes, and risky mating behaviors are a factor too.
This female advantage in longevity is something that goes back millions of years.
The sex that spends more time caring for offspring tends to live longer. Researchers say mimicking the preventive care habits of women could help narrow the gap. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Hundreds of climbers have gotten stuck on Mount Everest. There's a storm that dumped heavy snow on their campsites. Rescuers have been able to reach about 350 other climbers who were trapped on Tibet's side of Mount Everest. One report from a climber says the snowfall was so heavy that it had crushed tents. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Drexel University, whose cooperative education program positions students to explore future careers before graduation. This is experiential education. More at drexel.edu.
KEXE was first on the air in 1976. Recently, a couple of the founders, Rich and Susie McClear, stopped by to talk about why KEXE was needed then.
A lot of people were up here thinking they were doing their own thing. And when the radio station came on the air, they found a neighbor was doing the same thing, or somebody across town, and it magically became there are a lot of us up here that have the same thoughts, the same activities.
Neighbors talking to neighbors. We help them get in contact with each other and talk to each other about common problems.
KEXE is still needed now. We're connected through green cheese trivia, through great music and events. We're in crisis mode. We have had all of our funding cut from the federal government. Please help us out. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you so much for your support.
Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on.
On a Monday, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. In a few minutes, we will speak with Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland about the latest on the negotiations to fund the government, or more accurately, the lack thereof. But first, let's describe where things stand on this Monday morning. Today is day 6 of the government shutdown. Senators are reconvening today to vote on temporarily funding the government, but both parties seem pretty dug in on their positions at the moment. NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram is with us to talk it through. Good morning, Deepa.
Hi, Michelle.
So, any progress between the two parties over the weekend?
Pretty much no. There's been no movement or progress on ending this government shutdown. Republicans in the House have already passed a measure that would temporarily fund the government until November 21st, but things are held up in the Senate. And that's because Democrats are asking for an extension of health care tax credits to be included in this bill that would fund the government. And these tax credits are set to expire at the end of this year in 2025. And they're these credits that help people with health insurance through the Affordable Care Act, because it kind of offsets costs of the premiums of those healthcare plans. And these tax credits were boosted during the pandemic. It's helped make healthcare insurance more affordable. And without these credits, premiums on average would go up 114% for consumers. And that number is according to KFF, a nonpartisan health research group.
Okay, on average, they'd go up 114%. Okay. So what are Republicans saying in response to these Democrats' demands?
Well, Republicans are saying that right now the priority is to fund the government. And once that happens, then Congress can turn to these health care tax credits that are about to expire. Though I will say, you know, there's no guarantee that there's enough support to extend those credits. In the meantime, there's this messaging war going on. Republicans are saying that Democrats are holding up the vote on reopening the government. The White House even has a timer on their website for how long they say Democrats have shut down the government. Democrats on the other side say that Republicans are the ones holding it up because they refuse to negotiate.
And what about the president? What has he had to say about all this?
So Trump was in Norfolk, Virginia yesterday for a speech that was marking the 250th anniversary of the Navy. And he briefly mentioned the shutdown when talking about paying service members, because active duty service members are not getting paid right now under the government shutdown. But they will get their money back when the shutdown is over. And later in the day, Trump also said of Democrats, quote, it's their shutdown, not our shutdown.
The administration is also talking about laying off government workers, I guess firing them because of the shutdown. Yeah. Has the White House shared any more details about this?
No, but yesterday Trump said like the firing of federal employees was, quote, taking place right now, but details are still unclear. On Friday, I was at the White House in the briefing room, and White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said that the Office of Management and Budget was meeting with agencies to determine where some cuts could happen. What is interesting, though, is how the president has been openly saying that he wants to target, quote, Democrat agencies in these potential cuts. And in addition, the administration has been canceling these funds that are destined for projects in blue states.
And as we said, the Senate reconvenes today. Any idea what we could expect to see on the Hill?
There hasn't been any movement towards any kind of agreement or common ground over the weekend. So while the Senate is getting together today, Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson isn't convening the House. He says that he won't call in his own members until Senate Democrats agree to reopen the government.
That is NPR's Deepa Shivram. Deepa, thank you.
Thanks.
Many federal workers are already furloughed, and the Congressional Budget Office says more may be as the shutdown goes on, eventually totaling 750,000 people.
One employee at risk is Mark Cochran. He is a tractor driver and arborist at Gettysburg National Military Park. He's also a union rep. He represents National Park Service employees in the Northeast as president of AFGE Council 270.
My daughter's just started college. You know, the whole hopes of, oh, I have a vacation, you know, that's gone out the window, because pretty much any extra money I may have is going towards her education. You know, I'll try and see if I can find some side work to bring some cash in.
He has spent more than a decade working for the Park Service, and he says he could get paid more in the private sector, but he likes working at Gettysburg.
I mean, even when I'm out working in the rain and it's cold and miserable, just the thought of the sacrifices that were made at that spot really helps get you through.
It is a beautiful spot. Now let's hear from a legislative intern on Capitol Hill. We're using her first name only because in this political climate, she fears for her safety. Ashley started working for the government last month and now is on leave without pay.
It's very difficult being here in D.C. and not knowing how long this is going to last, how long I'm going to be living without getting a paycheck.
Which makes her rethink her interest in government work.
I didn't realize how truly deep the political lines really are, even on Capitol Hill. I don't think the public sector is honestly a very stable place for someone to start their professional career at the moment.
Longtime federal workers like Chris Jennison also experienced the 35-day-long shutdown in 2019.
We were actually expecting our first child at the time. My wife was pretty pregnant. We were newer feds. We had less salary. We had less savings. We had less stability.
This time, with no baby on the way, there's less stress. As an employment lawyer with the Federal Aviation Administration, he's also used to negotiating.
The fact that our representatives can't do that and find a solution and instead are punishing everyone who's a public servant and the public at large is really, really frustrating.
Under a 2019 federal law, furloughed federal workers are guaranteed back pay once politicians reach a funding deal. However, the Trump administration has also threatened to fire federal workers as one of its ways of punishing Democrats. So how does this end? On Friday, we interviewed White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt, who said Republicans were trying to persuade a few moderate Democrats to come to their side. Today, we've called Democrats, Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland. Senator, welcome back.
Steve, good to be with you.
I just want to remind people of the numbers. Republicans would need 7 Senate Democrats in order to prevail and reopen the government. They do have 3. Are any more of your colleagues defecting?
Well, Steve, I think it's important that people understand that Democrats have voted 4 times to reopen the government. We want to reopen the government without giving Donald Trump a blank check to continue his lawless activities, including, by the way, taking what they called a chainsaw to federal agencies. And we want to address the issue that Donald Trump claimed to care about, which was rising costs and prices in the country and they did leave a ticking time bomb in place on healthcare. And if we don't defuse that bomb, people's healthcare costs are going to go through the roof. So, yes, we have put our proposal out there. Republicans have voted that down 4 times in the Senate. And as you heard, the House isn't even showing up.
But just to be clear, are all the Democrats, other than the three who voted for the other side, are all Democrats still united so far as you know?
Yes, because all Democrats want to prevent the President of the United States from engaging in lawless activity, and all Democrats want to make sure we don't see an explosion in health care costs for the American people.
I want to ask about the lawless activity that you mentioned. I mean, you've made the shutdown about health care tax credits for the most part, but you now raise this other issue, which I know Democrats want to deal with in the longer term. The president does what he wants, including violating laws and saying the law is unconstitutional. The Supreme Court has largely deferred to him, at least temporarily, which does leave Congress. Are you saying you hope somehow to get a restriction on him out of Congress in the coming days?
Well, if you look at our proposal, the one that we have been voting for, it does include provisions to address this illegal unilateral withholding of funds from Congress. I mean, even Senator Collins and Senator Murkowski have acknowledged that when the president unilaterally withholds funds, that that's illegal. And we can change that. And in our proposal, we do create guardrails and safeguards against that, Steve.
Okay, with all of that said, the administration is moving to punish or retaliate against Democrats. Last week, we heard the administration said it was canceling clean energy projects in 14 blue states, $7.6 billion in total for clean energy. And I noticed that one of the states affected is your state, Maryland. Have you heard from the people affected and how much damage is done here?
Yes, they have been threatening to do that. They haven't necessarily invoked that yet, but this is another example of what the Donald Trump administration has been doing since day one. I mean, they've been withholding funds from Maryland, from FEMA projects, meaning projects to help some of our communities prepare and mitigate against future damages in hurricanes. They've been withholding funds for NIH. So it is important to recognize that they've been shutting down parts of the government since day one, and their threat to fire people in a shutdown just shows how vindictive they are. There's nothing in the law that gives the president any more power to fire people in a shutdown. In fact, as AFGE states in the lawsuit they filed 2 days ago, there's actually less authority for a president to be able to do that in a shutdown.
This is really interesting about the clean energy grants, because it was my understanding that Russell Vogt, the president's budget director, said in a social media post, we're canceling this. It sounds like you just feel they have threatened to do that and have not really stopped the flow of money.
Well, they did say they've canceled it. I mean, I haven't heard directly from the people on the ground that this fund has been totally terminated, but I expect them to follow through on that threat. I also expect that the state of Maryland will be part of another lawsuit against these illegal actions by the Trump administration.
One other thing, you did mention the possibility of firing people, which they've repeatedly threatened to do. A lot of your constituents are federal workers, to state the obvious. You're right there outside Washington, D.C. In about 20 seconds, if they start firing people on a large scale, how, if at all, will you respond?
I will respond in two ways. Number one, supporting the litigation, the lawsuit that's already been filed by the Federal Employees Union,
right,
making it clear it's illegal, and also doing everything I can to reopen the government, but again, without giving the president this blank check and dealing with the health care cost issue.
Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, thanks for your time, sir.
Good to be with you.
This is NPR News.
You are listening to the Monday Morning Show on People Powered KAXC. It's 6:19. I'm Jennifer Barr. There is a lot ahead, including Minnesota Native News at 6:30, and we'll hear Laura Erickson speaking for the birds. Coming up at 8:10, a bright spot, we are going to meet Connor Steffen, who recently completed more than 2,700 miles bike ride from Seattle to Grand Rapids for a cause. He is promoting men's mental health. Support for KAXE comes from Atchison Tire in Grand Rapids, providing service and offering tire brands like Bridgestone, Firestone, and Toyo, serving the area since 1916. More at atchisontire.com. And we thank Lake Country Power, a Touchstone Energy cooperative committed to community and giving back through scholarships, youth programs, Operation Roundup, and more. Lake Country Power, made by the community for the community. Weather today, much cooler than it's been. Sunny skies, highs in the upper 50s to low 60s. Northwest winds 5 to 10, gusting higher. Partly cloudy tonight, lows in the upper 30s. And for tomorrow, sunny, highs in the mid to upper 50s. Itasca Pride hosts The Occasion, an adult prom, on Friday. Tickets include dinner, dancing, and transportation. Find more info at itascapride.org. And let us know what's happening in your community. You can send us an email, psa@kaxc.org.
PR comes from the station. And from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Arm, on the latest episode of Tech Unheard, Arm CEO and host Renee Haas talks to Dr. Farnam Jahanian, president of Carnegie Mellon University, about how tech and AI are helping to shape the future of computing. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Come check this. If you scrolled through Plessis Alhaked's Instagram account before October 7th, 2023, you would have found snapshots of the young journalist set to music, lounging by the beach in Gaza City, hanging with friends, getting glammed up, celebrating Palestinian culture. It all took a dark turn soon after Hamas attacked Israel.
Okay. It's during quiet times, all the neighbors.
Al-Aqad started chronicling Israel's response, showing the world what it was like to live under Israel's relentless and, as you'll hear, terrifying bombardment.
And here is the family. They're gathering all together, also in a place far away from the wind. I was trying to explain things, but I think you can hear them now.
Every so often, Al-Aqad posted pages from her diary until she was able to leave Gaza. Those pages have turned into her new book, The Eyes of Gaza.
This diary isn't my story alone. It's the story of millions of Palestinians. This book is a reminder that history didn't start on October 7. History for Palestinians started in 1948 in Nakba.
Nakba is the Arabic word for catastrophe, and it's what Palestinians use to refer to the forcible displacement of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their homes in 1948 when Israel was created. She would hear stories about it from her grandfather.
So I always thought these stories are exaggeration until I lived them myself. And until now, the whole world is seeing them live, being reported and documented on TV.
You wrote in your book and your diary, quote, "In the morning, you see people being forcibly removed from their homes and it breaks your heart. And in the evening, you play with two kids for 5 minutes and it heals something inside of you." I noticed that you often brought up children who you encountered during your reporting in your daily accounts. Why do you think you focused on kids so much?
The thing is, the first 7 years of your life, your experiences, it shapes who you are as a person. And in Gaza, children are not allowed to be children. Right now, kids in Gaza are growing up afraid of the sky, because when they look at the sky, there's either bomb leaflets telling you to evacuate. And even when there is clouds, you look at them and you can't differentiate, are these clouds or are these smoke from a bombing? There are a lot of babies who recently got born during the genocide, and they don't even know what a home is like. They know what a tent is, but they didn't get to live in a home or experience it.
You also wrote a lot about how you didn't want Palestinians just to be known by death and destruction, that there is joy and love. And I'd love to hear more about that effort, because I think about your Instagram pre-October 7th really was about celebrating fashions and food and what Gaza is and what Palestinians in Gaza are.
Instagram used to be, for me at least, a platform where you open, you catch up with your friends, what are people posting, what are they doing with their lives. Oh, my friend got married, she posted a picture. Oh, she has a baby. Oh, she traveled, she went for uni. Like, that's what we're used to see. But right now, you learn about your friend's death from Instagram. So right now, even Instagram for Gazans is different than the rest of the world.
There is this moment in your book where you get on Instagram and you realize one of your high school friends has been killed, and that's how you find out. Or there was another moment where your best friend, Dana, is she still in Gaza?
Yes, she's still in Gaza, and I spoke to her actually yesterday.
I remember in the book where you get so excited when you see her name pop up on your screen, because you only hear from her sporadically. Is that still the case?
That's still the case, because she keeps evacuating a lot. So whenever she's like in a place, oh, she has internet, that's like for 5 days, then she needs to evacuate again, try to find internet again. So it's like an endless loop of displacement that has been going on for 2 years.
I never imagined it would go on for 2 years.
Neither did I, to be honest. The last time we spoke together, I thought, oh my God, Israel is outdoing themselves. There's nothing more they can do. But here we are a year later, and there is still more evil that Israel is doing.
There was this section in your book that really struck me. You wrote, in Gaza, you'll find mothers of martyrs celebrating the sacrifice of their children. Does this mean that they're pleased that Israel killed their children? No. But are they proud that their children give their lives for Palestine? Yes. It's an act of giving meaning to the worst loss a person can possibly endure. We don't celebrate death, but death is all around us, and we need a way to convert it back to life. Can you tell me about this passage, what you meant about making sense out of senseless death?
Yes, this reminds me, actually, when I was once in the hospital with Lena and her family. Lena is a little girl that I used to tutor. And Israel has ordered all of us people in northern of Gaza to evacuate. And that day, almost everyone felt it's the end, Israel will kill all of us. And Lena's dad started saying, don't worry, guys, at least if we get killed today, it's like we're getting killed for a cause bigger than ourselves. It's like we're getting killed for Palestine. So it's okay. But obviously, it's not okay. But it was us trying to make sense of that moment.
You start the book describing the Gaza before October 7th, the cafe you and your friends especially love to go to. I mean, if you could just describe in detail the Gaza and your neighborhood that you loved so much before and what is left of it today?
Even though it's a simple question, I actually find it a difficult question to answer.
Yeah.
Because when I look at pictures and videos of Gaza, you can't even recognize it anymore. Literally everything is getting wiped out. Churches, mosques, schools, buildings, streets, cafes, restaurants. It's hard for you to recognize the areas. So whenever I try to remember my memories and my life in Gaza, it's like I'm remembering something that in real life it no longer exists. Like it exists in pictures, but in a way it doesn't exist anymore.
Plessia Lakad, her new book is The Eyes of Gaza. It was her diary in Gaza, and it is now out for the world to read. Tomorrow marks 2 years since Hamas attacked Israel. We will speak to a hostage who survived Hamas captivity but lost his daughters and his wife. He wrote a book about what he lived through. This is NPR News.
Beth Macy says she grew up in a poor and dysfunctional family, but her Ohio hometown was rich with diversity and community back then.
In my hometown, which was a hotbed of abolitionist activity and an underground railroad haven, there were now Confederate flags flying.
Hear how Macy returned home to uncover what changed for her new book on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock this afternoon here on People Powered KAXZ. Your local host will be Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. It is 6:29. I'm Jennifer Barr. You are listening to the Monday Morning Show on KAXZ. Coming up, we will have Minnesota Native News and Laura Erickson speaking for the birds. Today, we're going to learn about saw-whet owl banding. Taking a look at our current temperatures, 35 in Aiken and Park Rapids, 41 in Brainerd and Grand Rapids and Hibbing, 38 currently in Bemidji. A mix of clouds and sun today, kind of depending on where you are. Highs 57 to 60, winds from the west gusting up to 20 miles per hour. Mostly clear overnight, lows in the upper 30s, areas of frost, especially on the eastern Iron Range. And tomorrow, sunny, highs in the mid-50s, and tomorrow night, looks like widespread frost is quite possible. And for Wednesday, sunny with highs in the low to mid-60s. You can answer our question of the week, what do libraries mean to you? You can text us, 218-326-1234. Support for KAXZ comes from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at moveitrealestate.com. We also thank Schroeder Log Home Supply, supplying wood home and cabin owners with specialty sealants, preservatives, and wood finishes. More information at their Grand Rapids store or online at loghelp.com. It is time for Minnesota Native News.
Welcome to Minnesota Native News. I'm Marie Rock. This week, we're sharing a special extended conversation with voices you've heard in earlier reports. Here's Travis Zimmerman's interview with Wenaw Wetopi food truck owners Ann O'Keefe and her husband, Frankie Jackson.
What's going on, brother?
Hey, how you doing, man?
I'm doing all right. Just start right off. What is the name of your food truck?
Wenaw Wetopi.
And what does that mean, or what's the significance of the name?
You know, if you're from a Dakota family and you had a grandma that you grew up around, it was pretty common for you to hear the phrase Wenaw Wota, which means come and eat. Pluralize it by adding the P at the end, I guess, to make it grammatically correct. But for those of us who grew up in a Dakota household with, you know, a mom or a grandma who spoke or an auntie who spoke, that phrase Wenaw Wota is very familiar.
Nice. What do you serve in your food truck?
Right now, we've been doing a lot of chicken chipotle bowls. We've started some beef chipotle bowls as well. Always some form of fresh fruit. Like we'll do fresh strawberries and cream. We try and have like a little bit more of the whole foods, healthy foods. We do buffalo at different times for more catered events, wild rice salads. I'll just throw in this a little bit too. How we even came up with the food truck was originally we have the art bus and we have our nonprofit, Minnesota Arts. But originally we looked at getting the food truck because all Native communities, right? When you gather, you eat. So anytime we were going to have our art bus at an event or be at a powwow or a gathering, eating is part of that process as well. So that's why we wanted to make sure that we could feed people.
Sounds delicious. I did try some of your food when you catered that event at the History Center, and I enjoyed that.
Thank you.
So who owns the food truck and who are your helpers? Who do you got to help running it?
So it's myself and Frankie are the owners. And then usually on the work in the food truck is either my sister, Eileen, who's one of the best cashiers I got, able to talk and work the crowd at the same time of taking orders. And then my daughter-in-law, Sandy. Yeah, usually it's my sisters and then our kids when we can get our daughter, Kyla, to help with us too. So, but Frankie's behind the scenes and really anywhere he's needed, he steps in. It's a tough learning curve of not only food trucks in general, but just food. You know, when you need to have your food manager's license, when you need to find wholesalers for your food and distributors and having commercial kitchen space. And, you know, there's just a lot to it that people don't see. And finding people to help you, people that you can trust and, you know, can work really hard. And for both Frankie and myself, it's hard because when we do these events, we want to always represent ourselves, our family, our community. So you want to make sure people are happily fed and you want to make sure you leave good impressions in your communities. And so that's important. My mom's a big cook. Frankie's mother's a big cook. So when you have people who've cooked for you your whole life, you know how important that is to have good food, making sure that we could do events well, you know, have suppliers for ourselves when we need it for events, but then also, you know, try and put out something good. And sometimes you do things because you just want to see if you can do it. Because my sisters will tell you I'm the least of the cooks in this family. I have a lot of sisters who cook, but I look at it more at the business end of it.
Yeah, that's great. Where'd you find your truck?
Actually, it was in our community. Another community member had it who actually does fry bread. And she just said, it is just too much work. When we bought it, it was 4 years old, but it looks seriously brand new. It looks brand new. She even like purchased it originally from Texas, drove to Texas to pick it up and everything. It was custom made. So we're lucky to find that so close and in such great shape. Because some of them are pretty rough. Like when you see some food trucks in general, they're pieced together pretty creatively. And it's orange. That was like a selling point for me. If you can ask Frankie, most of my things now are orange. Everything follows the food truck. A lot of our floral work now that we're putting on our art bus too is going to be orange. So it was like a no-brainer. And that was pre-pandemic too, or right around the same time. So you could get a food truck for a decent price. Right now, food trucks are outrageous. So I was very lucky to have the opportunity. And I thank her a lot since then, because it's been a great thing, a great ad for our family and for our business to have that.
That's all for this week's episode. Join us next time for more voices and stories that inform, uplift, and shape our communities right here on Minnesota Native News. You can find Minnesota Native News on social media. Follow us on Facebook at Minnesota Native News and on Instagram and X at MN Native News. Minnesota Native News is produced by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
Find more at MinnesotaNativeNews.org. It is 6:36. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show here on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Malachi Coons joining me in the 7 o'clock hour. We'll have events up north. We'll take a closer look at the many events happening throughout the region this week. You can find a full list of those events at kaxe.org. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. And coming up at 7:45, another installment of What We're Reading with Grand Rapids Area Library Children's Librarian Tracy Campa. She'll have some new and noteworthy children's books for us. And that's our question of the week. We want to know what libraries mean to you. Some of our area libraries are facing budget cuts and loss of hours, and we want to hear what those libraries mean to you or have meant to you throughout your life. Text us 218-326-1234. It's going to feel chilly out there if you haven't been out yet compared to our most recent weather, especially. We've got temperatures in the mid-30s to low 40s throughout the region, 35 in Park Rapids and Aiken to 41 in Brainerd, Grand Rapids, and Hibbing. Now it is time to hear from Laura Erickson speaking for the birds.
My birding buddy Michael Bernstein recently made reservations to visit Hawk Ridge's Owl Banding Station for this past Saturday night, and he generously invited me to come along. The Hawk Ridge Bird Observatory traps somewhere between 600 and 1,700 or so tiny northern saw-whet owls every fall. They provide opportunities for small groups to observe the banding and public programs for larger numbers of people to learn about owl banding and see banded birds just before they're released. Unlike hawk banding, owls caught at night are not lured in with what looks like potential prey. If an owl happens to be flying in the area, it may or may not get caught in a mist net. In hopes of drawing curious owls from a wider area, the banders were playing recordings of long-eared northern saw-whet and eastern screech owls while we were there. They never play recordings of larger owls. On the very rare occasions that a great horned or barred owl does appear on site, it may try to grab one of the little owls from a net, hurting or even killing the little bird as well as getting itself entangled. Fortunately, this hardly ever happens. When a larger owl is caught, the banders usually take it somewhere else to release it. The main push of migrating saw-whet owls up here is in October, but they start migrating in September after the young of the year are fully independent and the adults have finished molting. Owl banding at Hawk Ridge starts on September 15th, and during the first 7 nights of banding this year, they'd caught a respectable 32, but then it picked up enormously. On just the 5 nights from September 23rd through 27th, they caught 250. As usual, the only owls they've caught so far are saw-whets. All but 7 of these are now wearing a new U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service leg band. The exceptions were already wearing a band when they got caught. A great deal of information can be gleaned from those rare encounters with previously banded owls, which may have been banded at Hawk Ridge, but also at some distant place recently or years ago. On Saturday, we arrived at 7:30 just as the banders were setting up their mist nets. They checked the nets every half hour. At 8 o'clock, they'd already caught one, and at 8:30, 3 more. Our group stayed until about 9 after they'd released the last of these and the banders had to leave to check the nets again. Through the night, they caught a total of 35. It's of course a crapshoot whether any owls at all show up on a given night. Owl migration is very weather dependent, heaviest when there is no precipitation and winds are light or northwesterly. Ideal conditions cannot be predicted in advance with any certainty, but the Hawk Ridge staff provides a lot of valuable information in a wonderfully accessible way. So on the few nights that the experience falls short of superb because of lack of owls, it's still pretty darn good. I've observed saw-whet owl banding at Hawk Ridge and other banding stations several times over the years, and it's always a treat. Once in a while, one of these tiny owls will show its displeasure by clacking its bill, but they never bite or claw at the people handling them, and their curiosity always exceeds their annoyance, making it a genuine joy to watch them watching us. When one is ready to release and has had time to adjust to the darkness, very often the banders allow one of the visitors to hold the bird in their flattened hand until it flies off. On Saturday night, one flew off almost instantly, 2 remained on a hand for several long seconds, and 1 remained on a hand for over a minute. They're so light, their feathers so soft, and their eyes so bright that holding one for even the briefest moment is one of the sweetest experiences a person can have. I'm Laura Erickson, speaking for the birds.
You can find more at lauraerickson.com. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Monday Morning Show. It is 6:43. I'm Jennifer Barr, and it's KAXE. We receive support from Escape by the Lake on Paul Bunyan Drive in Bemidji, offering immersive themed experiences where teams work together to solve puzzles and find clues to escape within the hour. Learn more about the different themed rooms available at escapebythelake.com. Weather today, a mix of clouds and sun, highs 57 to 60, winds from the west up to 20 miles per hour. Clear tonight, lows in the upper 30s. There will be some areas of potential frost, especially on the eastern Iron Range. And tomorrow, sunny highs in the mid-50s, and then widespread frost expected overnight. And Wednesday, sunny with highs in the low to mid-60s. The KAXE KBXE Book Club is reading How to Solve Your Own Murder by Kristen Perrin for October. Meetings are at 5:30 Wednesday, October 8th at KAXE Grand Rapids, Tuesday, October 21st at KBXE in Bemidji. This week has been declared National Banned Books Week by the American Library Association. There will be an open reading at Minnesota North College Itasca campus in Grand Rapids this evening, 7 o'clock in the McMahon Student Center. Community members are invited to read or listen to passages from their favorite books that have a history of being banned. Thanks so much for tuning in this morning. We will have more ahead from Morning Edition from National Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. And from Subaru. Subaru has donated more than $70 million to support the adoption, rescue, transport, and health of over 700,000 animals. Learn more at subaru.com/pets. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A Florida man named Al Salvi noticed something recently. The electricity bills are rising in Pembroke Pines, and he told our colleague Scott Horsley that he pays up to $500 per month.
Seniors down here that are living check to check, now we got to decide whether we're going to pay electric bill or we're going to buy medication.
Why is this happening? We called Robinson Meyer, who is executive editor of the climate and energy site Heatmap News. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so we hear politicians say that higher electricity prices are about the kind of energy we use, fossil fuels versus renewables, whatever fits their agenda. But it seems you've been focusing on some other factor in electricity prices. What is it?
That's right. So I think the biggest driver of the run-up in electricity prices we've seen over the past 4 or 5 years, because electricity prices have really shot up since the pandemic. They've been rising twice as fast as overall inflation, is the grid itself. And not only the grid itself, it's actually the most local part of the power grid, like that last mile from substations to your house or business.
I don't automatically get that because the wires are already there and have been there for generations. Why would that get more expensive?
In some cases, it's because they've had to be rebuilt because of a natural disaster. And in some cases, they are just getting old. It's actually exactly the fact that they've been there for generations. They're getting old and they need to be replaced. And in some cases, it's because maybe a wildfire burned through an entire area, especially out west. And now the utility has to go in. And not only does it have to rebuild that grid in the local area, it also has to rebuild it in a way that's not as likely to cause a wildfire in the future.
This is sounding like an unseen cost of climate change.
It is, I think, a cost of climate change. I mean, I think it's just that we've had the grid for a long time. I mean, in many places, it's 90 or 100 years old, and it's time for those systems to be replaced. And unfortunately, they're beginning to be replaced at the same time as we're seeing rising electricity demand for the first time in the U.S. in basically a generation.
What is increasing the demand for electricity?
So it's a few things. I think the headline driver is this boom in data center construction and AI, of course. And that is having big effects in certain parts of the country. The other things driving electricity demand are population growth and economic growth. You know, people are getting richer and they're using more electricity. There are people switching to EVs. You know, if you think about going from gasoline to EVs, you got to plug in your car. And then the last thing is something that I think everyone across the political spectrum wants to see, which is more U.S. manufacturing. As factories have gotten built here, that drives higher power demand too.
Is it inevitable then that as AI expands and if the U.S. succeeds in reshoring some manufacturing that I'm just going to pay more and more for electricity?
Well, it shouldn't be. And this is one dynamic that I think regulators and state leaders are grappling with right now. In the New Jersey governor's race, electricity prices have become a huge deal. And while I don't think electricity prices are increasing in most areas right now because of AI, I do think there is a good case that AI is driving some of the electricity prices in New Jersey specifically and data centers specifically. Historically, kind of the way it's worked is that the utility builds out the grid to meet demand from everyone, and then everyone kind of foots the bill for that expansion. I think right now, given that just a few customers are driving so much more electricity demand, utilities and states are trying to figure out how we can, you know, meet that demand while not having absolutely everyone else pay much higher costs to build the infrastructure needed to service those facilities.
Robinson Meyer of Heatmap News, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
This is NPR News.
It's 6:49. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. We'll have more ahead from Morning Edition, and coming up just after 7 o'clock, we'll have a special edition of the Up North Report with Larissa Donovan. We receive support from Edward Jones financial advisor Christina Gallas, helping individuals and business owners reach their financial goals. More information at edwardjones.com. Edward Jones member SIPC. Temperatures right now in the upper 30s to low 40s. And for today, we can expect a mix of clouds and sun with highs 57 to 60. Winds from the west gusting up to 20. Mostly clear tonight with lows in the upper 30s. There could be some areas of frost, especially on the Eastern Iron Range. And tomorrow, sunny highs in the mid-50s. And tomorrow night, widespread frost. So be prepared for that. And on Wednesday, sunny with highs in the low to mid-60s. You can answer our question of the week. We want to hear about your experiences with libraries, what they mean to you. Text in 218-326-1234. You can also help shape the future of our cultural programming by taking a survey on our legacy shows. Find the link at kaxe.org. There is more ahead from Morning Edition on People Powered KAXE.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. France's prime minister resigned today, less than a month after he was appointed, in response to the last French political crisis. Now, France is one of those countries that has a prime minister and a president. President Emmanuel Macron is still on the job and has accepted the prime minister's resignation, all of which Eleanor Beardsley is covering from Paris. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi, Steve.
Who was the person who just resigned and why so suddenly?
Well, his name was Sébastien Lecornu, it still is. He was defense minister before. He's a Macron loyalist from the center-right. Macron appointed him last month to replace the prime minister who was brought down right before him in a no-confidence vote. Actually, the last two prime ministers were brought down that way because the far-right and far-left, who control the biggest blocs in parliament, weren't happy. They both want someone from their camp. And last night, when this new prime minister finally named his government, they were already saying, the two extremes, we're going to bring him down because this is the same old people, the same faces, a reshuffling of Macron's previous governments that they call Macronie. And so this morning he resigned on his own, to everyone's shock.
Wow. So his government lasted less than a day. What's the fundamental issue he's facing here?
Well, this all started about a year ago when Macron made a very risky move of dissolving parliament, thinking he could increase his small majority. Instead, he lost it. Today, no party has an outright majority, but as I said, the extremes on the right and left have the biggest voting blocks. So the governments have been hobbling along with an ever-shrinking center. The country's divided. France has massive debt, and there's disagreement over how it should be addressed. And the far left and right, they don't want budget cuts that Macron's proposing. They want to tax the rich or end immigration and pay less to the EU. I went to some demonstrations a couple days ago from the left who are protesting Macron and all of his prime ministers. They're chanting here, tax the rich. They say Macron's not listening to the people. Here's 25-year-old student Pierre Rappé.
For our generation, we are very engaged ecologically, socially, and we face strong inequalities in the sense that multi-billionaire people in France control a huge percentage of the patrimony and have huge power, and we are here to fight this.
Okay, lots of passionate people, but what happens to the government now?
Well, that's what everyone is debating this morning. Macron, he's kind of running out of options. He can't keep repeating the same move. People are saying, some analysts, that he needs to, you know, name somebody from the left or dissolve the National Assembly again. But there's a lot of pressure, Steve, because we have a presidential election coming up in a year and a half. Macron cannot run again. There's a lot of politicians jockeying. Here is the outgoing prime minister speaking this morning to the nation.
Être premier ministre est une tâche difficile.
Yeah, he said it's very hard to be prime minister. He had met with social partners and they were coming to agreement on things over the last month before he named this government. He said, but the lines have hardened. It's impossible for him to do his job. He said France could make it, but to succeed, there has to be humility, a tamping down of egos. And he said, you got to prefer your country to your party.
Sounds familiar. Eleanor, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And NPR's Eleanor Beardsley.
This might be something you've seen in your own family or neighborhood. Women are much more likely to live longer than men. On average, women in the U.S. live about 5 years longer. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports on why and what men can do to try and close the gap.
There are several factors that help explain the gender gap in lifespan, and researchers at the Max Planck Institutes in Germany wanted to know more, so they studied it in hundreds of species of animals. Study author Fernando Colchero says one reason females outlive males is due to risky mating behaviors.
What we found is this female advantage in longevity is something that seems to be part of the evolution in mammals. So it goes back millions of years.
In many species, males tend to grow bigger and stronger, he says. Take deer, for instance. They grow antlers during the breeding season to establish dominance and fight off rivals in order to reproduce.
They tend to do that to be able to pass to the next generation as many genes as you can. But that comes at a cost, and that comes at a cost in their survival.
A study of animals in the wild may seem far afield from the reality for humans, but Colchero says there are several parallels that shed light on why women outlive men. For starters, genetics plays a role. Females' two X chromosomes may be protective, and males engage in riskier behaviors at higher rates. Alan Geller of the Harvard School of Public Health points to two examples. Men smoke more, so though the gap is narrowed, they are more likely to die from lung cancer, and he also points to skin cancer.
It's fascinating because the incidence rate of melanoma is a little bit higher in men versus women, but the mortality rate is much higher in men compared with women.
Part of the explanation is that men are less likely to protect themselves from the sun. According to survey data from the CDC, only 12% of men are in the habit of using sunscreen when they spend time outdoors on a sunny day. In addition, hormones and biology play a role. Geller says males are more likely to be diagnosed with aggressive melanomas, and it turns out men are less likely to get screened for cancers.
Men are less likely to go to their doctor to ask for skin cancer examination or examine their own skin. And so you have a double whammy.
The study of mammals also found evidence that the sex that spends more time caring for offspring tends to live longer. An evolutionary explanation is that the caretaker parent needs to survive until their offspring are independent. And though gender roles have evolved a lot in modern society, and certainly there are men who are very proactive in health and parenting, the gap persists.
I think it all still falls back on gender differences, where men are less likely to play these roles as active health seekers, and it's often left to the female significant other in the family to play that role.
Colchero says the evolutionary pressures that produced this gender gap cannot be overlooked, but in humans, he's hopeful the gap can be narrowed.
There are ways in which we can reduce it to some extent, no? And maybe mimicking some of the behaviors that women have of, yeah, let's make sure that we go to the doctor and do not miss that appointment with the doctor. That should help us.
So will preventive screenings, attention to a good diet and exercise, and prioritizing social connections. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands. With therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone. At BetterHelp.com/public.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
It is a minute before 7 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 in the Brainerd area and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can find more at KAXC.org. We heard from quite a few people over the weekend showing their support for the station with their donations, so thank you so much for that. You can become a member anytime at KAXC.org. Click on that donate button. Temperatures throughout the area range from 34 in Park Rapids to 41 in Brainerd, currently 40 in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, 39 in Bemidji, and 35